And welcome to episode 127 of Tea or Books. My name's Simon.
I'm Rachel.
In today's episode, we will be discussing, do we have guilty pleasures when it comes to reading? And in the second half, two similarly titled novels, The Vicar's Daughter by E.H. Young and The Clergyman's Daughter by George Orwell. Before we get to that, Rachel, how are you doing? What are you reading?
I'm very good, thank you. Just gone back to school after the Easter holidays. Had a lovely time in Malta.
Wow.
Which was a wonderful place. So much history. Really enjoyed it. Very interested, actually, if anyone knows of any Maltese writers. I didn't actually come across a bookshop while I was there to have a look. I know. But Valletta did not have any bookshops that I could find. But yeah, I would be interested to read something or read something set in Malta, actually. Any recommendations? Much appreciated. I read an enormous amount while I was on holiday, which was a joy because I haven't had much reading. So you might remember, Simon, I said in January one of my goals for the year was to read more intentionally and to get some classics read that I've not got around to.
Yeah.
And so the number one on my list was 100 Years of Solitude.
Oh, wow.
I bought this at the airport. And Julie read it, and I wasn't expecting to enjoy it because you know how I feel about magical realism, but I surprisingly absolutely loved it.
Is that your first Marquez?
I think it might be. I might have read a novella of his before, but I mean, I just thought it was absurd. I mean, it was mad, but wonderful. So I'm interested to explore more of his. So Love in the Time of Cholera will be coming next. And I also read, highly recommended, Wifedom by Anna Funder, which is fairly new, and it's about George Orwell's wife. And I read it because I was a clergyman's daughter while I was away, and my school librarian recommended it. And she, I mean, I'd seen it in the shops and was planning on reading it at some point, but my school librarian had just got it in on the last day of term, so she quickly, bless her, put it all in the library covering for me, and then said, right, you take on your holiday. And it was wonderful. So so it's like it's a biography, but there's elements of fiction to it, because as she explains in the book, there's not really much out there that's available about George Orwell's wife Eileen, his first wife, I might say. And
yes, is it Sophie, the second one? We know quite a lot about her, don't we?
Sonia, yeah. But they were only married for like a week before he died. And she writes so beautifully, and it's really an exploration of not just about George Orwell's wife, but also, I mean, Eileen, I should give her name, as that's the whole point.
Yes.
but also about the hidden work and of women throughout history, of the nature of being a wife and what that means, that you are always in the background, that you and in so many creative relationships end up, even though if you're creative yourself, end up having to subjugate that creativity, or you're there, you're supporting and you're helping and you're inspiring work that you never get credit for. So I thought it was absolutely marvellous, and I'd recommend it to anyone. Even if you don't know anything about George Orwell, you're not into his literature, you don't really need to know anything. It's all explained to you in the book, and it's just made me want to go read more. So I'm now on another George Orwell novel, and I've got a stack ready to go. So,
Which one are you reading now?
I'm reading Burmese Days.
Ah.
His first novel.
Not read that one. And it was Wifedom by Anna
Funder.
Great. Well, that sounds really good.
Yeah.
Well, at the time of recording, we are halfway through the 1937 club that Karen and I are running. So I'm reading 1937 books this week. By the time this goes live, I think the week will be over. But I will admit, I don't think I've read anything particularly brilliant for it, which is a shame. But I'm currently reading A Bullet in the Ballet by Carol Brahms and S.J. Simon. I'd heard of them. Brahms and Simon, I think, wrote quite a lot of detective novels. And this one, I mean, Bullet in the Ballet is a very clever title. And it's all set in a ballet and someone died during performance, but it's very arch, maybe slightly too broad in its humor, I guess. Right. No one really feels very real, and I get the impression there probably won't be a lot of actual detection happening. But there certainly don't really seem to be any clues or anything. But it's a very self-aware, occasionally sort of breaks, like references the fact that the characters have all read lots of detective novels and so know what they're doing. But yeah, I'm not loving it. The weirder one that I read this week for the 1937 Club is a Rose Macaulay novel called I Would Be Private, which, it's not one of her well-known ones for sure. And it's about this policeman and his wife who have quintuplets and get so much public and press attention that they move to a Caribbean island. Which in my review on my blog, I said was very far-fetched, ridiculous idea that they get that much attention, they'd have to move. And then lots of people in the comments told me that apparently in the mid-1930s, there were quintuplets in Canada, the Donny maybe family, who everyone but me seems to have heard of, who were basically turned into a freak act, I assume with the parents' volition, maybe not, I need to find out more. But so it's probably loosely based on them, or at least inspired by them.
I love it when readers of your blog can give you information you wouldn't have come across otherwise. Wonderful.
I know. It never struck me that it could be real. But I'm hoping there are some people. Had you heard of the Donny quintuplets?
No.
Yeah, not just me. That makes you feel a bit better.
No, never. There we are. Maybe maybe they're more famous in Canada and the US.
Yeah, true. Good point. But I think my favourite one I've read is one that you might like called Theatre by W. Somerset Maugham, which is about this very brilliant stage actress called Julia, who is middle-aged and still a star of the stage, but not the youthful ingenue that she once was. And she starts having an affair with this younger man, who is her husband's accountant or something, and it all goes a bit awry. But she's a fascinating character, and it's really clear that Mom knows and loves the theatre and theatrical people, and knows that world inside out. Really enjoyed that one.
Well, that sounds like right up my street. I have to look out for it.
It does. Yeah, it was turned into a film with Annette Bening called Julia, or Being Julia, or Becoming Julia.
I remember that.
In the early 2000s, mid-2000s maybe. But it's quite strange that it was this. I mean, it might be in print, but it's certainly not a famous novel. But 70-plus years after it was published, it got turned into a film with Annette Bening. Why not?
There we are.
So, first topic. Thank you so much, Rebecca, for getting in touch. I'll just get your email up so that I say what you said. Hello, meowing cat in the background. Not talking to you now. She said, we phrased it as, do we have guilty pleasures? Rebecca wrote, what's your guiltiest reading pleasure? I'm currently meant to be reading an impossibly dreary 700 plus page novel for my book group, and I somehow ended up spending Saturday concentrating not on that, but instead reading an extremely frivolous and highly enjoyable romance, which would not stand up to any kind of critical scrutiny, but was about 100% more enjoyable than the alternative. But as well as thinking about our guiltiest reading pleasures, we're going to talk about whether we have guilty reading pleasures at all, whether we ever have had them, what sort of things we think of or think that other people might think of when we could talk about guilty reading pleasures. Rachel, what comes to mind?
Well, I mean, I think for me, it comes down to those books that are, a bit of fluff. I guess in some cases people would consider middle brow fiction to be a guilty pleasure in terms of not particularly intellectual, not particularly intellectually demanding, but something that you can relax and enjoy. And I've got plenty of these, and I'm not ashamed of them. I love anything by Miss Reed. Have you ever read anything by her?
Yes, well, I think we've talked about, because I took you, didn't I, to Thrush Green?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and I have read some, and we did one on the podcast actually, the one about the teacher.
Oh yes, of course.
I can't remember the name of it. No. So I've read maybe three or four, and I don't love them as much as you do, or as much as indeed as my mum does, but I do enjoy them.
They are for me the most perfect comfort reading, and when I just want to switch my brain off and lie down and just be immersed in a world where nothing really bad ever happens to anyone. And it's all just very cozy. That's what I go for. Because they are these kind of halcyon pictures of life in the mid-century in a what was then a sleepy village. I mean, I was quite taken aback when you took me to Thrush Green now, because, I mean, it's essentially just a little bit of a much larger town. But it's just one of those things where all the world outside seems to be going mad and everyone wants to kill each other. You can just sort of read these books and think, do you know what? People are fundamentally nice and everything's just fine. you know, it's like having a big cup of hot chocolate on the sofa on a windy afternoon. So Miss Read is probably my the top of my list of what I would consider books that really are, you know, that the writing isn't up to much, but I don't care, because the story is so good, the characters are endearing, you just have that sort of connection. And I suppose another guilty pleasure of mine would be I love Ruby Ferguson's books, which I think most people would consider to not be particularly literary in any sense. But I love Lady Rose and Mrs. Memory, which is a Persephone book.
And published, I think, in 1937, just for a 1937 club link.
Goodness, there we go. Look at that. I didn't even know, but it was like that. and those books are just lovely. And I suppose my third guiltiest pleasure, I'm sure we'll come up with more as you speak, and I'll be like, oh, yeah, me too. Third guilty, very guilty pleasure when I'm really not very well and I can't cope. You know, like when you've got a terrible head and it's just you can't concentrate on anything. Is Mallory Towers' books by Enid Blyton. Going back to my childhood, my boarding school stories, which I love.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this because, as you say, some of the sort of bitter fluff middle-brow novels that would have certainly been considered guilty pleasures maybe at the time they were published or in subsequent generations, because I also studied them academically, it's a weird sort of mix of being guilty pleasure, but also for a period, literally my job, I guess, at one point to read these sorts of things, or more often read articles about them or theory or that sort of thing. But there's a real crossover now between things like, which I think sort of thing I read, like, I know, The Love Child by Edith Olivier, which is, I think, well written, but it is, you know, quite silly and inconsequential in some ways, but also I spent a year writing a chapter of my thesis about it, so I know it's sort of both. I think my guiltiest pleasure is, I think I've mentioned in the past that I don't normally like reading romance. It doesn't really interest me. The exception apparently is when it's audiobooks, when I'm suddenly very happy to go down the sort of, I know, Richard Curtis style rom-com book. Completely formulaic. I listen to quite a lot. They're all completely interchangeable. I've no idea which one's which. At the moment I finished it, I've forgotten every specific detail about it. But when I'm driving and have an audiobook on, I like it to either be, as I've probably said before, either factual or just really plotty. Like, well-written stuff doesn't appeal there. So I'm just after that sort of nonsense. So I wouldn't dream of reading these if they were paper books, but I really enjoy getting through them by the bucket load as audiobooks.
I think that's wonderful. And, you know, the joy of an audiobook is no one can see what you're reading.
It's true. I'm always slightly worried when I get to work and I'm like, I don't want this to start playing in the office. And people will be like, I thought he was literary, but he's listening to someone be like, oh my gosh, what if they kiss me? Because, I think even the people who write them probably can't tell them apart. And the people who write these things, they write so many. They get a new book out every few weeks, it seems. I don't think anyone's laboring over these. But So, I think the through line is probably going to be that we don't feel particularly guilty about our guilty pleasures, but other people might think I should feel guilty about that one. Because, you know, I've got this time in the car. I could be listening to Proust or something, but no.
Well, I think it's really important that your brain has a break sometimes, and that also you can indulge in kind of a simple world where you don't have to kind of think too much about the morality of a character or really try to puzzle out what something means. Sometimes you do just need that just sort of restful reading. It's like people don't really feel snobby about watching crap TV, do they? But when it comes to books, it's like we're all supposed to be reading something that's very highbrow.
Yeah, or films. Like, I watch so many rubbish Netflix rom-coms and I, you know, loud and proud about it. But yeah. Thinking more broadly, one of the other things I feel a bit guilty about is rereading. And I don't know if you feel the same. And there's obviously some people who reread loads of stuff. But whenever I'm rereading anything, unless it's, you know, for the podcast or for book club, if it's something I just want to reread for fun, I feel guilty then because I'm like, this, I've got 1,700 books I've not read. How can I read this one again? And that's not a type of book, but a sort of, I guess, a type of reading experience is when I feeling guilty. Do you, when you're rereading, do you think about all the books you haven't read yet, or are you just enjoying the rereading?
Yeah, I'm the same. It's often I'll think to myself, I mean, every year I think, right, you know what, this is the year I'm going to reread all of Dorothy Whipple's books, which is another guilty pleasure of mine. But then I think, oh yeah, but I've got this huge pile of books that I've just bought and I really need to get through them. And if I spend time on that, then I haven't done this. And I feel like, well, I already know these books. I already know they're good. I don't know about these other ones. So yeah, there is that sense of you're wasting time on that when you could have been doing something much more productive. Or actually, for me, the guilt comes from knowing that I've been really naughty and just bought another new book when I've already got a bazillion that I haven't read. And then to think, I haven't read loads that are on my shelves, I've just bought new ones, but instead I'm going to go back and read something I've already read. It feels like, yeah, it feels like you're being naughty, doesn't it? Like you're responsibility somewhere.
Yeah, and somehow the process has broken down of like books in, books read, but if you're going back to the ones that are already there. And I did used to feel guilty very long time ago about having so many unread books. And I found up to about 100 unread books, I felt guilty. And once you get past 100, you're like, well, it's gone. It's out of control now. So there's no point looking back. And now I've got, you know, as I said, 1,700 or so books I've not read. It doesn't really matter if I throw a few more on the shelves. I'm never going to catch up.
So, yeah. Nothing to feel guilty about.
And then I think what Rebecca mentions or refers to is probably the time I actually feel guiltiest, is when I know I should be reading something else, particularly if it's a book club book I don't want to read, which my Village Book Club, I love it, but it's really opening my eyes to how much mediocre historical fiction there is out there. And because, you know, the ones that sort of break through tend to be the good quality ones, whereas the ones the library buys 20 copies of, they just, I don't know, they're fine. I just don't see why. I just don't see the point of it. I just read The Plant Hunter by someone. I forget. Mugford. So, it might be an adventure novel rather than a historical novel. It won the Winston Graham Prize for something or other. But the whole time I was like, I just don't understand why I'm reading about this man who travels across the world to get a plant. Nor why the author insisted constantly on telling me how good looking he was for no reason. Just kept saying so-and-so with his model good looks. Like, I get it. He's hot. Why? What's adding to the plot?
I'm terrible actually for when I know I ought to be reading something, often for a book club or for school. And I start reading and I'm like, oh, it's just too much and I'd actually rather be reading this. So then I'll or a long book that's taking me ages and I'm getting bored, and rather than just being sensible and just cracking on and getting it finished, I will stop reading it to read something else I think will be more fun. And then I go back to it for like another couple of chapters and I'm like, oh, this is just so long and it's taking me ages. So then I'll go back and I'll read something else that I'd rather read that's a naughty book, and then come back. There is a guilty pleasure in abandoning a book for another one that you're enjoying more, knowing in the back of your mind. It's like, you know, when you're at school and you're supposed to be revising and you're doing anything, but it's that kind of naughtiness, which is kind
of... I think we've just used the most wholesome ever use of the term naughty book. But yeah, I think that is absolutely the guiltiest I ever feel. You know, it's like book creepers tomorrow. I've got 400 pages left of this book I don't want to read, I'm going to pick up this Persephone book instead or something. And sometimes I just feel too guilty. I'm like, well, I'm going to watch TV instead or something. It's like, well, that's not going to, it's not helping get the other book read, but it somehow feels less like I'm cheating on what I should be doing.
That's the way our minds work, eh?
Yeah. I know. I think there are people out there, you know, doing heroin, and here are us feeling guilty about reading a Ina Blyton book. Trying to think what else. Have there been times in your life where you felt guiltier about choices of reading? Have you felt less guilty if you got older? Have you always felt the same way?
I think I feel less guilty now about doing things like, if I'm not enjoying a book, just stopping.
Mm.
But in terms of, do I feel less guilty about, no, I do have that kind of completer finisher thing of like, if I know I have to finish a book, like even if I'm not enjoying it, you know, I have to finish it because I need to do it for a particular purpose. That feeling of like, oh, I'm just not going to read it tonight and I'm going to read something else. I will the whole time I'm reading the other book. I won't be enjoying it as much because I know in the back of my mind, oh, I've got to go back and finish that other book. So it's a bit of a useless exercise, really. I should just crack on and do what I'm supposed to do. But I never learn, and I'm probably never going to. Okay.
Yeah, I think when I was about, I don't know, 12, and I was reading lots of Sweet Valley High, I felt guiltier about that. Being like, what if people find out I'm reading all these Sweet Valley High books? What would they think of me? But now I'd quite happily open a Sweet Valley High on the bus.
Good for you.
Although I did, years ago, I did try that one that Francine Pascal wrote that was like 10 years on from the final book. And I think, in fact, it was the only book she wrote in the series because she just came up with the idea and marketed it or something. And it was so bad that I gave up after maybe 30 pages. It's like, is this much worse than I remember? Or am I just, I just doesn't hit the spot anymore? I don't know.
It's a shame.
Yeah.
Yeah. There we are. So, I mean, I think it's obvious that neither of us feel guilty about
reading. No guilt. Books. No guilt about specific works. Some guilt about when I should be reading something else, but overall I'm going to say no to guilty pleasures. I just have reading pleasures, not guilty ones.
Exactly. And you know what, reading is a pleasurable activity, and nobody should ever feel shame about anything they read. As I always say to my kids at school, all reading is good reading.
Absolutely. This is why, actually, slight tangent, but when you see people saying, mocking people for not wanting to read Lolita because it's, you know, gross, or I don't know, that sort of thing, and think, that's fine. That's a very acceptable response thing. Unless you're like an academic, then saying, I don't want to read this because it is not bringing me pleasure, is a legitimate reason to stop reading a book. And you don't need to be, you don't need to explain yourself or, you know, justify yourself. It's just like, I don't want to, so I'm not going to.
Exactly.
Great. Thank you, Rebecca, for getting in touch. Yeah, this is the same Rebecca, I believe, I think, who took umbrage at my dislike of Barbara Pym titles. So we like Rebecca, she's great. We have a quick question for the middle section from Lindsay, which is about Anthony Trollope. Where should she start?
Oh, well, do you know what, I haven't actually read hugely widely with Anthony Trollope. You're probably more of the expert than me, so I'm going to leave this to you, actually.
Well, I also haven't had I haven't read very widely. In fact, I've only read the first three novels of the Barchester Chronicles. Is that what I mean? No, but Barsetshire Chronicles. Yeah. And in fact, Lindsay says, I've heard you both speak positively about Trollope, but I'm intimidated by the length of his books and my lack of knowledge. And so that's why, where would you suggest I start? Which Trollope should I read first? And that's why I think what I did was starting with The Warden is really good, because not only is it the first in a series, it's also really short. So if you're intimidated by the length, The Warden gets you into that world. I also, people often said to me, I should start with Barchester Towers, which is the second in the series. But I actually prefer The Warden. I think Septimus Harding is just the loveliest character to spend time with. And it's a series that's a lot about church politics, or particularly that book, but it's really just about the politics of human behavior. It's like what I understand, I've not read them, of the Palliser ones, which are all about actual politics. It's really just about people and how they behave with each other. It doesn't matter particularly in Trollope's hands, whether you have an existing interest in the area he's writing about, because he just writes so well and so amusingly about people. I think he's like the sort of perfect halfway point of Jane Austen and Charles Dickens, because he has the comedy of manners and the really interesting characters that Austen has, but also the slight surreal humour of Dickens comes in there as well, or like the sort of way he uses exaggeration in his sentences in the same way that Dickens does. So I love him. I only read one every couple of years because generally they are really long and it is a bit of a commitment, but I think he's marvellous. And I just think start at, if not the beginning of that series, just pick one of the other series and start at the beginning and then keep going.
Yes, I love how what you just said there about it being a halfway point between Austen and Dickens. I've not thought of him like that before, but I think that's a very good comparison. I started my Trollope journey with He Knew He Was Right, which is the first in the Palliser series, and I absolutely loved it. It was brilliant. Yes, it's very long, but you just rip through it because the story's so good, you just want to keep reading, and it's very easy reading. It's not like if you say like Dickens to someone or Austen to someone, where they often think, I was just having this conversation with a student today, actually, he's writing an essay on Pride and Prejudice, and she was saying how she often had to go back and reread sentences. And I said, well, yes, I do too, because they're so dense. There's so much in them. She's clever with her language. And Trollope isn't quite like that. I mean, he writes beautifully, but it's not obtuse.
Yeah.
You can just crack on with the reading and you get through it quite quickly. So, yeah, I really must actually read more of his.
Well, we could always brave it, and actually, you know, if we have enough planning, we could do a couple of Trollopes if we've got time for hundreds and hundreds of pages.
Yeah, give me a couple of months notice and 3 months
maybe, and I'll go. Well, I hope that helps, Lindsay. If anyone else has recommendations, I've not read any of the standalone ones. I know there's plenty of those too, but I think he's not as well read, I think, as Austen and Dickens, or certainly not, you know, in the cultural conversation as much, but I think just as worth visiting.
Yes.
So, finally, an E.H. Young novel and a George Orwell novel with confusingly similar titles, which I thought was a fun idea at the time. It's going to be quite hard to talk about, but which would you like to introduce us to?
I will do A Clergyman's Daughter, please.
Fab. The Vicar's Daughter by E.H. Young is one of her earlier novels. She's better known for things like Chatham Square and Miss Mole, but this one's a bit earlier in her career. And it's about this guy called Morris, who is a sort of locum vicar. He's been looking after this rural community whilst his friend Edward is away. And he's staying on for a little bit whilst Edward and his wife Margaret and their adult daughter Hilary come back to the village. And yeah, it's sort of basically about the tension there, because Morris, we learn quite early on, is in love with Margaret and more or less always has this very sort of tense, awkward relationship with Edward, and it's quite intimidated by this youthful Hilary. There's also the mysterious housekeeper Caroline, who started working as a housekeeper at the house of two brothers who live in the village. So I guess, yeah, there's not a huge amount of plot, but it's basically about the complexities of that various different emotional ties and conflicts and politics going on between that small cast of characters.
Okay, thank you very much. So A Clergyman's Daughter by George Orwell is, I believe, his second novel. Was written in, I want to say, 1935, but I could be making that up.
I think 33, but it's around there, isn't it?
It's around there. Feels right. And
you're 35, you're right, sorry. Carry on.
That's a turn up for the books. I'm normally just... and the protagonist is Dorothy. She is the clergyman's daughter of the title, and she lives with her father. Her mother's died several years before. Her father is the clergyman, but he is not particularly interested in being a clergyman, and he is very, very self-involved, incredibly narcissistic man, who is not particularly nice to Dorothy and expects to be waited on hand and foot. So poor old Dorothy has a very hard time of it in the living with him, managing him, looking after him, but she also does basically all of the work in the community that he should be doing, working herself to the bone. And she's constantly feeling very bad about herself and, you know, the feelings she sometimes has. And there is a kind of village Lothario who has taken an interest in her, and he's got children by another woman, and he causes all sorts of gossip in the village. And one night she is enticed to come to his house under false pretenses. And then the next day she comes to herself, and she's wandering. She's in the middle of London, wearing someone else's clothes, and she has absolutely no memory of who she is or where she's come from, which is very unexpected. It's sort of the second part of the book. And from there, we see her life as she is on the streets of London, gets taken off to do hop picking in Kent by a group of vagrants who take her with them, and then ends up homeless, essentially. And then I don't want to say too much because it will ruin the plot, really, but it's interesting to see the two halves of her life and then how she decides to move forward at the end.
Great, thanks. And yeah, where would you like to start the conversation?
Well, I mean, I think for me what was interesting is, I suppose, I was expecting very different things from these novels. I think I was expecting a kind of exploration of what it was like to be the daughter of a clergyman. I in my head I was thinking along the lines of The Rector's Daughter by F.M. Meyer, which is a wonderful novel, and looking at both of them being early 20th century novels, looking at perhaps the life of a spinster or something like that, and they very much are not that. And what's interesting particularly about The Vicar's Daughter is it's not actually, I mean, that is what it's about, but not in the way that you expect. And the focus of the narrative actually really is on Morris, I certainly think. I mean, I have to confess, and I will say this to everybody, I found it so dull, I couldn't get past the halfway point, so I didn't.
Oh, no.
but certainly in the first half, it's very much about him. And I don't know whether you would agree with me on this, Simon, but I felt that he was very much a bit of a Mr. Collins.
Interesting. So I will say the clever thing with that is that The Vicar's Daughter isn't necessarily who you think it is.
Oh, yes.
I don't know how, yes, but
that out, yeah.
Yes, but it's definitely about Morris. And I think, yeah, he very much is a Mr. Collins figure. What I found really interesting about the novel, as a concept, I guess, is it's one of the very few times I can remember having this central character who is so ridiculous and so annoying and so unable to have proper connections with other humans, and yet we're meant to sympathize with him. He seemed to me very much the sort of character like Mr. Collins who would be introduced as a joke or as a misery or something, as a side character. And to have him be the emotional heart of the novel felt to me really unusual and novel, and made it, I know, in some ways quite awkward to read, because I certainly wanted better for him than he was getting. But it wasn't like that when Edward or Margaret were mocking him, either to his face a bit gently or behind his back slightly less gently, that we were meant to think they were bad people or wrong. We're thinking, yes, you're completely accurate, he is terrible at communicating with other people and so self-centered, but was just very fragile ego, so always worrying about what people are thinking about him, always worrying that he's doing the wrong thing, and they are thinking bad things about him and he is doing the wrong thing. So yeah, that felt to me really, really unusual as a decision for the author to make, and hard to spend time in his company knowing that, I guess.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I've read several of her other books and very much enjoyed them. So I just couldn't understand why she'd made that choice to have such an unlikable and frankly irritating character as the centre of the novel, and somebody who we're supposed to care about, we're supposed to be invested in him. I mean, for me, I was like, what is this book? It's going absolutely nowhere. I tell straight from the start, it's like, oh, who's this random girl who's turned up at the vicarage? He's exactly the same age almost as his other daughter, and he was having a relationship just before he met his wife. So it's like, okay, fine, so she's his illegitimate daughter, I get it, I'm not stupid, you know, like I figured that out by chapter two. So it's like, where is this going to go then? Like, what's more for me to care about? I didn't get the point. And it was all very, like, dramatic. I was like, so what if he's had a kid with someone else he was with before he met his wife? What does it matter? It just didn't feel like urgent or that it mattered in any way, shape or form.
Yeah, I found it interesting as a character study, but I did also find it really hard to read because I thought the writing style was quite clumsy and just a bit opaque. Because, yeah, as you say, I've loved other of her novels, although I think even the novels I love, like Chatterton Square, there are sections of the prose where it does just feel a bit dense, and she's very good at dialogue in that novel, I think less so in this one. But, I mean, I did finish it, and I didn't dislike it, but I did think it was comfortably the worst book by her that I'd read. Actually, is that true? The Mrs. Mallet also isn't very good. But, well, let's also move on to Clergyman's Daughter, where it starts being like that sort of novel you described, like the Ephemeral, because it is just the daily routine of this girl who, or young woman, who is really put upon by her father, the vicar. And I thought he was one of those great sort of masculine ogres of fiction who is not violent, not anything like that, but is so manipulative, so selfish, and able to twist anything to make it seem like he's the one being wronged. Mm-hmm. So when she's been up for 2 hours getting the house ready or doing visiting people or something and is slightly late with his bacon, he's like, how am I expected to be a minister if my bacon is burnt, or if, you know, if it's not on the table when I'm here, I've got to do all this work, and she's just running herself ragged. And I loved all that bit, and then, as you say, she gets amnesia, and I was like, what are you doing, George? What's going on? I just such a bizarre choice, because it wasn't like she bumped her head even or had an accident.
It's never explained.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, it's quite bold just to be like, "Don't worry, it's just happened. Go on with it." And then it becomes more a sort of social realist novel, I guess, particularly the hot picking and the homeless bit, which, you know, George Orwell often, as we know, brings in political points or social points into his novels. I felt in this one much less subtly than in anything else I'd read about him. Because it's not even like working it into the narrative. It's just like, here's a whole bunch of different characters. We're not going to see those ones again. And now we need to learn about what homelessness is like.
Yeah, I mean, I actually loved it. Thought it was brilliant. I thought, this is a writer who's experimenting, and I'm loving it. That central section where they're in Trafalgar Square and you've got all these voices of different homeless people, that was essentially like a verbatim play, really. Mad, absolutely mad. Doesn't love at all. I didn't like it, but I admired him for having a go. Writing. You know, this is a time when the novel is being really played with, and writers really are experimenting and trying out new things. And this is only his second novel. He's very early on in his writing career. And you can see him here trying out what works and what doesn't work, because he doesn't do that in any of his later novels. So he obviously thought, I'm going to give this a try. I'm going to see how it works. And I love that boldness of also being like, yeah, she's got amnesia. I'm not going to tell you why. And actually, after a while, it doesn't matter. You do just accept it. You don't need an explanation. I mean, the reality is probably she's had some kind of mental breakdown because of the situation that she's been in. He doesn't need to spell it out for us. We can fill in the gaps. And I thought, you know, it's very down and out in Paris and London, you know, that whole section there, and, you know, her going hot picking. And I mean, yes, it is slightly crowbarred in, but thinking about it in terms of what he's trying to do, thinking about the genesis of him as a writer, and it's so well written and so enjoyable to read. And I loved the later part where she's working in a school, because it's
I thought you would, yeah.
So true. The management, I was like, I recognize all of this. I won't say too much in case anyone else. I just really enjoyed it. I felt saddened by the ending, but I also felt that it was very realistic, unfortunately. And yeah, I just thought it was a one as a as someone who, you know, I love literature as you do, and I'm interested in particularly writers like George Orwell, who, you know, wasn't a particularly great person, but in terms of, in many ways, especially now I've read Wifedom, but thinking about the variety of his work and how brilliant his work is, his body of work, and looking at this in terms of, this is a very early work of his where he's working out who he is as a writer, I found it really interesting to read from that perspective. Does it all work as a novel? Maybe not, but it's still a really good read, and it's fascinating to see him trying out ideas that are going to be developed further in later texts. So that was my view on it.
Yeah, I definitely agree that it's really well written. I read this straight after The Vicar's Daughter, and it felt like coming up for air. Oh, to quote another George Orwell title, accidentally. but it felt like being able to breathe again after the sort of clogginess of the sentences in E.H. Young. I think Orwell is just such a brilliant prose stylist in with his clarity. I think we've talked about that before. He's not the sort of Virginia Woolf style great prose stylist where it really draws attention to the writing, but there's just that wonderful clarity to his sentences that at the same time is just beautifully written. And that was definitely evident here. I did skip most of the play dialogue section after. I was like, I don't know who these people are. They all sound the same. I just basically flicked through and read her sections because I thought that might be useful. And yeah, I mean, the amnesia thing, I think I could have coped with it if she'd just woken up with amnesia in that village. I think what more bothered me was that we just suddenly had an entirely new cast of characters. And I was so interested and invested in the world he created in the first 70 pages, whatever it is, that I thought, you're just starting a different novel. You've just got, and it felt in fact like four different novels. So we've got, yeah, we had the original, the Vicar's community, the hot picking, the homelessness, and the school section. And particularly the first and the last of those, I loved reading. I loved reading the school stuff. Mrs. Creevy, the landlady who also manages the school, who is just desperate to get any sort of financial stuff back. And it, from her, there's the bit where she's every morning she says that fried eggs are better if they're sliced up, so she can slice up the two fried eggs and then take one and a half for herself. Yeah. All these brilliant touches I liked. I thought it was less subtle than some of his later novels where, I think in his later career, he does have shown that. Whereas in this one, he sort of then had to follow on by explaining to us that Mrs. Creevy was stingy. You know, always explaining all the characters, not just showing what they were doing. But yeah, the school stuff, the rote learning, the parents who paid were basically could run the curriculum, and all the responsibility was to the fee-paying parents rather than to the children's benefit. All of that really interesting, a bit heavy-handed, but really interesting. But it was one for me where, the writing was brilliant, the characters were interesting, and for me the structure was so mad that it really let it down for me, and I couldn't. You said you were able to keep going and say it doesn't matter, I'll keep going. For me it was a block that never quite went away.
Right. I mean, I can understand that. I was more willing to go with it, I think. Yeah, I just thought it was a really interesting way of dealing with a social issue, whereas I didn't really understand what E.H. Young was doing with her book. I didn't know what the point of it was, what she would have
done. Yes, I thought exactly that. I got to the end of it. Because when I'm reading a novel, I very seldom think, what's the point of this novel? Because you just think it's about a group of people that you think are interesting. But this one, I was thinking, why is this a novel? What's the point?
Yeah, why did you write this? What did you want to say? And I don't think she knew, and that's the problem. So... <Yeah. laughs> And it was very turgid, wasn't it? I mean, gosh.
Lord, yes.
Yeah. Don't read it, everyone. Don't waste
it. Yeah, and I mean, she wrote a lot of novels that I don't see talked about that much, like, you know, Celia and Jenny Wren and things that may well be brilliant, but I don't see talked about. And like, you see Miss Mole talked about a lot. Mm-hmm. I think William is the best one of hers I've read. It's absolutely brilliant. But But then there's these ones like this one that... I don't see anyone talk about it, and maybe there's a reason. Yeah. I did think, considering they're both vicars or vicars' families, not that much about faith in them. There's more on faith in the Orwell, and I think he writes about faith very badly. Like, he's clearly not a person of faith, and I thought the way he wrote about Dorothy's faith made it clear that he didn't really understand what it's like to be a Christian. And again, slightly heavy-handed in what he clearly thinks about organized religion, but not in a way that felt to me very realistic as somebody who was, you know, part of an organized religion. What did you think?
Well, I don't know. I thought it was quite, it felt, I don't know. I thought there was an authenticity to it in some respects. But yeah, I felt that it was less overt, the kind of exploration of religion and obviously he was very critical of it, in the, is it a vicar? I can't, the Vicar's Daughter? If it is the Vicar's Daughter, the book's
right. Which, E.H. Young is the Vicar's Daughter.
E.H. Young, in the Vicar's Daughter, I felt it was interesting because it was, you know, there were lots of debates and discussions of religion, but it didn't really seem to me like Morris actually had any faith.
Yeah, it was a lot more about religion than faith, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and the sort of point scoring, I know the Bible better than you sort of thing. And yeah, it was interesting to think about the idea as well in both of them of community and the role of the church in the community at the time, and how really, as still is the case in many Christian denominations today, how much of the work falls to the female relative who isn't being paid for the job.
Yeah. And how much the church is basically, in these communities, social services.
Yeah.
And that's still true in many deprived areas. It is the church and other faith communities who are picking up the slack.
Yeah. So, I mean, there were elements, you know, to enjoy in both of them, but I think both of them had rather misleading titles
Yes. Well, I think Young was trying to be clever with hers, but as you say, like, it was one of these ones where the big reveal about her being the illegitimate daughter, it sort of was like, has it been revealed? Because it's so obvious, but I don't know if I meant to know yet. But, yeah. Yeah.
And also, why did you stop meowing?
Yeah. I might just have to shut Hargreaves out of the room because he's being very noisy. Okay. Yeah, I think my thought about both of them is, I mean, these are both authors that I have loved, and I think it's far from the best work by either of them. I know that you clearly liked the Orwell more than the Young, but for me, if anyone hasn't read Young or Orwell, I definitely wouldn't suggest starting with either of these ones.
No, I would agree with that. I mean, I did enjoy the Orwell and I would recommend people reading it, but I wouldn't read it as my first Orwell, probably, no. And I don't think, I certainly agree, it's not his best. E.H. Young, I would say, don't touch with a barge pole, but I have very much enjoyed, you know, I love Miss Mole, I love Chatterton Square. So I would certainly say she's still worth exploring, just not this one. I don't know what happened there. We all make mistakes sometimes, don't we?
Well, I say I've not read a few of her really early ones, and I think the only other earlier one I've read is The Mrs. Mallet, which also wasn't very good. So I think she was one of those ones who did get better and better as she kept writing.
And
look for later Young.
I just wonder who she knew at the publishing house to get it published. That's all I was.
Well, I didn't. I think maybe you disliked it more than I did. Yeah, because I think, I think the characters were really interesting to me. I didn't like them particularly, but I found them really interesting. But I think it was the complete lack of momentum in the novel that stymied me, and the sort of sluggish prose. But I did think Marissa was a really interesting and unusual character.
Well, I mean, you're more generous than me.
If you're listening, E.H. Young, do get in touch to let us know what you were thinking. So, Teal Books decision-making time. Oh. Just to confirm, Rachel, what are you going to pick?
I'm going with A Clergyman's Daughter.
Clergyman's Daughter. As am I, yes. Wow. I didn't love either of them, but I thought it was definitely better written.
Well, right decision. Well done.
Okay, thank you. We are entirely in agreement in episode 127. We'd love to hear your questions, suggestions, feedback, anything. Do get in touch at teaorbooks@gmail.com. We love it when you do. Rate and review anywhere that you might be able to do that. And you can see a list of all the books and authors we mentioned at stuckinabook.com. In the next episode, we will be doing 50 Sounds by Polly Barton, which is nonfiction about the Japanese language and about Polly's experience living in Japan. And to go with that, a book in Japanese, although we will be reading the English translation, The Housekeeper and the Professor by Yoko Ogawa. Look forward to seeing you then.
Yep, see you then. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.